Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We've been covering, and we're so much in the midst of the presidential primaries and caucuses. There are three of them, I think, happening today. Did you ever just wonder, well, how did we get the system that we have now, and why is it different from state to state, and when did party bosses just nominate people, and why did the Democrats have to change the way they went about getting their presidential nominees back in 1968? We have a lot to, and a lot of history to learn this hour, because we're going back to 1912, but we'll go beyond 1912 as well, and we'll go a little bit before 1912, because Fighting Bob La Follette from Wisconsin plays a role in this story. Our guest this hour is the author of Let the People Rule, Theodore Roosevelt and the Birth of the Presidential Primary. What could be more timely today? Our guest is Jeffrey Cowan, and Jeffrey is the president, he's the author of the book, and he's president of the Annenberg Foundation Trust at Sunnylands, and he is also the Annenberg Family Chair in Communication Leadership at the University of Southern California. Has an interesting background. He was a civil rights activist in Mississippi in the summer of 1964, and Jeffrey had a large role in increasing the number of presidential primaries in 1968. Some of you will remember that tumultuous convention in Chicago. Jeffrey is called the man who did more to change Democratic conventions than anyone since Andrew Jackson started them. Well, it's a very fascinating story about Teddy Roosevelt and Taft and La Follette and party bosses, and we'll learn all about it this hour. And welcome your phone calls as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. And Jeffrey, thank you so much for being with us.
What a joy to be with you, Kathleen, and to have a chance to talk to people in Wisconsin where so much of this really started.
It sure did. And actually, I think about this frequently, but I can mention it to you because you wrote about this. We're only, you know, less than half a block, just on the other side of the building that I'm in, is the place where Teddy Roosevelt was shot in 1912 and carried on with his speech.
Pretty remarkable. If he hadn't had that speech and a glasses case in his pocket, God knows what would have happened. But instead, he stayed as strong as a bull moose.
Yes, he did. All right, here's something that you've written, and let's start at this point. The man who embraced democracy. Well, no, let's start with why he decided that he was going to run again for president in 1912, what he thought about Taft, and then we'll get into all of the complexities of the primary system. But what prompted him to say, hey, I want another shot at this?
Yeah, well, maybe I'll set up for a second. I think probably an awful lot of your listeners know a lot about Roosevelt and remember him as the incredibly vigorous guy. He was a young man, had, you know, been chasing bad guys in North Dakota and been the police commissioner of New York and organized a group of fighters to go into the Spanish-American War that were known as the Rough Riders, and then became governor of New York and president of the United States with things like the Food and Drug Administration and the Panama Canal, and we thought of him, I think incorrectly, but as a trust buster and so forth. And of course, he protected all the majestic wilderness. And he became president in 1901 when he was vice president to William McKinley, and McKinley was shot in that fall of 1901. So he served almost a full two terms as president, and felt that he should follow the tradition that George Washington had created of no more than two terms for president.
Mm-hmm.
But then he picked as his successor somebody he considered the most lovable man he knew, the Secretary of War, as it was called in those times, William Howard Taft, a dear friend of his, a top lieutenant. Taft became president. Roosevelt goes off on a game hunting trip to Africa, so Rooseveltian, and then comes back through a triumphant trip through Europe, back to the United States. And by the time he returns, people are saying, we need you back in office. Taft has betrayed many of the things that you had been championing, including the protecting of the wilderness and so forth. So he at first doesn't want to run, thinks, well, maybe I could run in 1916 if I run at all, but I don't want to have to challenge my friend. But then he begins to feel, and I think this is what's so surprising, one of my surprising discoveries, like an isolated old man living in Oyster Bay, Long Island, and Sagamore Hill, a place probably again some of your listeners have visited, he begins to feel irrelevant and old, and decides that he really has to come back into the middle of the fray, both for the good of the country and because it will restore his own sense of importance and good health. And so he decides to do it. But the amazing thing is, Kathleen, and you know this from reading the book, and I think it's never been written about this way before, he at first thought he would get to be president by calling on of his old friends who he'd known as president, who were the party old party bosses. And he thought that he could get to be president by calling on their support.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, for the first time, there were primaries that were being created, thanks to Wisconsin's Bob La Follette and
right.
the Life Part. And there were six primaries that had been created by the fall of 1911. Roosevelt was against creating more primaries at that time because he thought that he could get it the old-fashioned way. But by January, and La Follette had decided to try to win with these new primaries, but by January of 1912, Roosevelt had concluded his only way of reclaiming the presidency would be to win primaries, and so he became the champion of primaries and adopted as his campaign slogan the name of my book, Let the People Rule.
Hmm. Oh, the way people want to be president, right? They say one thing one week, and by golly, the next week, they believe a whole different thing.
Well, at least you don't feel that something's different this year.
Yeah, right. Ain't that the truth? Why, you know, I've always read that Taft really wasn't crazy about being president. He really wanted to be on the Supreme Court and was, I think, eventually. But why didn't he just say, okay, Teddy, why don't you just, you know, I'm not crazy about this job anyhow. Go ahead. Just take it.
Well, I think it's a really interesting question. In fact, Taft, first of all, you're right up to Taft. Taft was not a born executive like that. And he was... and particularly didn't want to be that kind of leader. He did really love being a jurist. He had been a court of appeals judge and ultimately, as you say, became Chief Justice of the Supreme Court years later. And his temperament wasn't the same kind of go-get-em temperament that the TR's was. But on the other hand, when you're in the office, it's pretty hard to give it up. And everybody around you says, you're doing great stuff. And Roosevelt, he thought, was becoming irresponsible and radical at this point. And so he actually, Roosevelt, in when he began to run, Roosevelt decided he had to out La Follette, La Follette.
Mm.
So let's talk about this for a moment. It'll
sure.
also explain Taft.
Mm-hmm.
Here's La Follette, who genuinely was a progressive, who believed a lot of things. In fact, one of the things that you see in my book is that Roosevelt actually thought La Follette was more dangerous than Taft. From his standpoint,
mm-hmm.
he was standing between these two men, as he thought. La Follette's ideas were much too radical. And yet, Roosevelt's old friends and supporters, the people who were on, he had friends all across the political spectrum, but his more progressive friends were turning to La Follette, who was running, and TR wasn't really publicly running yet. So he decides that he has to convince the progressive end of the political spectrum, say the Bernie Sanders end today.
Right.
That he's really more progressive or as progressive as La Follette. So he adopts an idea in a speech that he gives in Columbus, Ohio, just before he announces for the presidency, where he says that if a law has been passed and then it's been overturned by a state Supreme Court, that the public should have a right to reverse that. That the Supreme Court of states should not be the final arbiter.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this shocked lawyers everywhere because they believed that there were sanctity, there were rights that were sanctified, whether they are civil, whether they're political rights or they are property rights, that they should be able to be protected by the courts. And once Roosevelt had taken that position, as one of his close friends said, it turned Taft from a man into an ideal.
Mm-hmm.
And so for people who believed in the sanctity of the courts and a certain process of getting things done, Roosevelt became enormously dangerous, and Taft became the man who stood between him and that kind of chaos.
Interesting. So you write, this is pretty remarkable, that the man who embraced democracy, Teddy Roosevelt, we're talking about, as his core campaign theme and had done so much to open up the political system, had been a skeptic, if not an opponent, of presidential primaries and suffrage for women only weeks before he embraced them. He'd pleaded for the support of Southern blacks, which is also a very interesting part of your book, on the Republican Party only weeks before he excluded them from his own party, simply because of the drive to be president again?
I think so. I think people, the drive to become president, and of course we see it playing out right now, I think for some people it becomes almost irresistible. You're convinced that you're going to do the right things for the country. You love being in the middle of the action. And for him, by the way, finances were no problem. Sometimes people fall out because they can't raise money anymore. He had kind of an insatiable support of money because of the support, and you know this from the book, of U.S. Steel, of all things.
Mm-hmm.
Because Taft had brought an antitrust case against U.S. Steel, and the U.S. Steel people were so angry about that, and they championed and funded much of Roosevelt's campaign, though he was running as though he was a progressive. His supporters were many of these Wall Street people who were the U.S. Steel people. Anyway, I think he believed this. One way of maybe showing what you just read about was what happened, something listeners may not realize, although people are learning it in this political year. The parties write their own rules. It's not like they're really written by state law. State law is important, but the parties write their own rules. And the rules, it's like the National Football League instead of being written by law. So the rules of the Republican Party were going to control in 1912 were written in December of 1911 at the meeting of the Republican National Committee in Washington, D.C. And the La Follette forces were at that convention saying there were now six states that had primaries. They were asking the Republican National Committee to adopt a rule that would encourage states to adopt primaries. Roosevelt's forces were at that same convention lobbying to stop that from happening.
Hmm.
Because Roosevelt was at that time against the creation of primaries.
Mm-hmm.
Until then, a month later, he realized that this was the only way that he could win. And in terms of women, La Follette was for women's suffrage. Roosevelt's position was it should be decided on a state-by-state basis, but be up to the people in those states and be up to those voters. Well, the problem with that system is, number one, women weren't part of the electorate in those states, so how are they going to say, we think we should get to vote?
Mm-hmm.
But also the La Follette forces and others were calling for a constitutional amendment, calling for the right to women to vote, and Roosevelt was against that until after the primary campaign was over in mid-June. Then, for the first time, he came out for a constitutional amendment giving women the right to vote. But throughout the campaign, he was against it.
Hmm. So he was looking at La Follette supporters as a potential source of putting him over the top?
Well, he knew that he had La Follette, let's say, broadly on his left, and he had Taft on his right. And his first goal was to get rid of either or both of them. So he decides to try to destroy La Follette, who he calls, by the way, the most dangerous man in public life at one time, in one of his private letters. He decides he has to get rid of La Follette. So he tries to get rid of La Follette in the most underhanded of ways. The governor of Michigan was a man named Chase Osborne. And Chase Osborne was the vice president of the National Progressive League, which had actually been created in La Follette's own home. And so on January 1st, 1912, Chase Osborne of La Follette was to give a speech in Lansing, Michigan, announcing that he was running for president. I mean, it was known, but this was going to be his big launch speech on January 1st. And Chase Osborne, working in league with Roosevelt's supporters, decided to use his introduction of La Follette to denounce him and call for him to not run and to be for Roosevelt.
Hmm.
So Roosevelt, in this very underhanded way, really, tries to destroy La Follette's candidacy. And for a time, La Follette actually falls out of the campaign. La Follette, and we know from Chase Osborne's own letters that he thought La Follette was really gaining tremendous strength. But La Follette, he has a kid who's sick at the time. The strain of what Roosevelt's doing and others are doing is undermining his health. And he gives a speech to the National
Publishers
Association.
You write about that. It is amazing.
Incredible. And he becomes this speech. First of all, Woodrow Wilson gives a wonderful speech as sort of at this major convention of magazines, which are at that time a huge source of news in the country and opinion. Wilson gives a great speech, and La Follette gets up to give a speech. And he wrote a wonderful speech, by the way, the one that he didn't ever really deliver. But then it's like he's drunk or he's delirious or mm-hmm. his mind goes away from him, and he starts to rant and rage and loses his place and shouts to the crowd and mm-hmm. goes on for an hour or two. People leave the place. He shouts at them as they're leaving the room, and everybody thinks that and he collapses, and people think LaFollette's campaign is over.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, astonishingly, LaFollette recovers a few weeks later, comes back into the campaign, and when the first primaries, and I want to just say for a minute for this, Kathleen, because
sure.
we're right in the middle of this.
Yeah.
The first primary ever was in North Dakota on March 19th, 1912. So we're right in that time frame.
Mm-hmm.
First primary ever. And in that primary, Teddy Roosevelt, who had been this, you know, cowboy rancher in North Dakota, thinks that he should get the voters. But actually, LaFollette has the spirit of that part of the country,
mm-hmm.
right where you are, kind of almost a neighboring state. And so the people of North Dakota go for LaFollette and don't go for Roosevelt, first primary ever. Second primary was held on March 26th, so a week later, in New York. And New York primary, here's Teddy Roosevelt, who's been the governor of New York and president of the United States. And yet he risks losing in New York. So he gives a whole series of speeches on the night before the election, on March 25th, goes all around the city giving speeches. And the last place he speaks, which is this casino with 3,000 people there, he gives a speech he's been giving all night, trying to ridicule Taft, who's his big threat in New York, mm-hmm. three-way race, really. And he says, I read today that Mr. Taft thinks you should be, and he says, in a falsehood of a, allowed to vote. And he says, I don't think you should be allowed to vote. I think you should have a right to vote. Well, every place he's gone, people have cheered and laughed when he said it. But this time, a woman stands up, a 26-year-old Irish firebrand who's a librarian and a member and a radical suffragist, stands up, shoots her head up in the air and says, Mr. Roosevelt, what about women? Should they be allowed to vote? Mocking his voice. It's a humiliating moment. And it turns out, because she wasn't yet for a woman's right to vote. And on March 26th, Roosevelt gets beaten 2-1 in New York.
Wow.
And a week later is the Wisconsin primary, April 2nd.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Wisconsin primary, third primary in history, LaFollette again clobbers Roosevelt. So three primaries in a row, Roosevelt is defeated, and it looks like the primaries, rather than being his friend, are going to be the source of his total humiliation.
Mm. So what does he do?
Well, so his last hope is to get Illinois to create a primary. Illinois didn't have a primary. It's a new state to have a primary. He gets the Chicago Tribune to do things that would today be certainly unethical and probably illegal. But the Chicago Tribune, partly owned by the McCormick family, but run by a man named James Keeley, runs a crusade for Roosevelt to win in Illinois. And they finally put a primary on the ballot. And the Chicago Tribune actually finances his campaign in Illinois, pays for his train as it goes around, pays for the lodging and so forth. But in Illinois, Roosevelt runs a terrific campaign. And for the first time, not only does he win Illinois against all odds, he wins by a vote of 2-1 in Illinois, wins every delegate in the state of Illinois. And all of a sudden, it's the first time this ever happened in history, fourth primary. But this primary creates a different kind of momentum, a different kind of narrative. Now people say the people really want Roosevelt. And all of a sudden, the public begins to think, this is a man who could be an exciting new president. And he then goes to Pennsylvania. And he wins hugely in Pennsylvania, supported, by the way, by the steel interests,
mm-hmm.
but wins in, and also some anti-Catholic interests, which he uses quite unfairly against Taft. But he wins in Pennsylvania, too. And now, this man who, for a moment, had seemed to be a humiliation, this former president, now with his campaign theme being, everybody should have primaries, give the people a chance to rule, let the people rule, he becomes the cause. He becomes the firebrand. He's out on the street. This man who had been feeling old and tired and irrelevant is all of a sudden in the middle of the nation's interest and rallies people to his side with the kind of excitement that you can see at a Trump rally. You may not be for him, but it's taking place there. or you could see it in a Bernie Sanders rally. He gets that kind of excitement going his way.
We're talking this hour with the author of Let the People Rule, that Theodore Roosevelt and the Birth of the Presidential Primary. Jeffrey Cohen is our guest this hour, and it not only does it look at this fascinating election year of 1912, which of course has Wisconsin connections in terms of our being the third primary and also the involvement of Fighting Bob La Follette, and the fact that Teddy Roosevelt was shot in the city where we are in Milwaukee in 1912, and people realized how tough he was because the speech was blocking the bullet, but he had this bullet and he kept talking and talking, I think, for about an hour. The place is marked. If you've never seen it, it's very close to the Hyatt in downtown Milwaukee. There's just a little marker there. So we're talking about this, but our guest also can move ahead because he has a really interesting personal story to tell. We also have to talk about what happened with African-American voters and how Teddy Roosevelt embraced them and pleaded for their support, and then he excluded them from his own party, which is really quite a story, and who those delegates were. They were very well-known doctors and surgeons and poets and all kinds of things. But he also, our guest, worked on the 1968 Democratic Convention and getting the Democratic Party to change the way that they nominated presidential nominees. That's also a fascinating story. So here's our phone number. Join the conversation as we carry on. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is at K Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Fascinating book on the primary system, how we got it, and particularly the election of 1912. Let the People Rule, Theodore Roosevelt and the Birth of the Presidential Primary. Jeffrey Cohen is our guest, and we're going to go to some phone calls, starting with Kenneth in Janesville. Hi, Kenneth.
Hello. Why are we here in Wisconsin, or why have we been told for the last 107 years, or, I mean, in our history classes, that we, the progressives of Wisconsin, are responsible for the primary?
Well, I think we were, weren't we? Didn't we start, progressives started the primary, right?
Yeah, that's definitely Jeffrey? Right. I mean, in the book, I tell the story of a senator from Oregon named Jonathan Bourne, who was the biggest champion of it. But absolutely, Robert La Follette is known to be, and Wisconsin is known to be, the place that championed the creation of presidential primaries.
Mm-hmm. But we didn't have, correct me if I'm wrong here, so we had them in Wisconsin for local and state races?
Right, but not for president.
Okay.
The first time that there were contested primaries for the president, where voters could actually express a preference for the person they wanted to be the president of the United States, was in 1912.
Mm-hmm. Anything else, Kenneth?
No, thank you.
Okay, thanks very much for the call. 800-486-8655. I really want you to tell the story of going back to what we were talking about earlier, Teddy Roosevelt first embracing African-American voters in the South, and then weeks before excluding them from his own party. It's a story that doesn't make him look great.
It doesn't, and actually I'm going to add one more thing to it, if I may. So
sure.
He goes to the convention. He's won. There have been 13 primaries. He's won 70% of the delegates in the primaries by the time he goes to the convention. He thinks he's entitled to it, a little like, let's say, Donald Trump thinks that he would be today.
Mm-hmm.
But instead of everybody having been picked through primaries, most were still picked through smoke-filled rooms, caucuses, conventions run by people who had patronage and so forth. And so the Taft forces are able to stop him from winning a majority at the convention. He has two ways of hoping to win at the convention, and one I want to mention, Kathleen, that's in the news today, is that he hopes that the people at the convention will cause something a lot like a riot if he doesn't get it. And he actually, you remember the story in which I talk about how his plan was to have the people terrorize them. And Herbert Hadley, who was his campaign, his floor manager, who was the governor of Missouri, and later Hadley describes how this happened, was supposed to call on the galleries, the audience, as well as their delegates, to basically charge the stage if Roosevelt wasn't elected, Hadley finally backs away from doing it, and because he just is afraid of too many people being hurt. But his real hope of winning at the convention was that he was about 50 delegates short, and there were 68 black delegates from the Deep South. And he tries to win those people over from Taft to himself. He gets a few of them to come, but not enough. So when Roosevelt walks out of the convention and starts his new party, those men, those African-Americans who did support him at great risk themselves, walk out with him across the street to Orchestra Hall, where he says, "We stand at Armageddon, we battle for the Lord, we're back in Chicago in 6 weeks, you go home to your own states, and you pick the people who are going to be coming, who are going to be at the Progressive Convention." The person from Mississippi who was expected to be the head of the new party was a man named Sidney Redmond, as you mentioned, a Harvard-trained doctor. Redmond and the others go back there and think they're going to start this new party. Redmond was African-American, and what they're told is not only can't they be leaders in the new party, they're not going to even be allowed to participate in it. They have trouble believing it. And so when Roosevelt's forces, or the forces claiming to represent Roosevelt, pick an all-white delegation, they pick a parallel delegation that's half white, half black, and two delegations from Mississippi and other southern states go to the National Convention in Chicago 6 weeks later, beginning of August, and say, each says they're the one that should be represented. It was such a brutal fight that the decision about whether to have the all-white delegation or the half-white, half-black delegation wasn't decided until 3 o'clock in the morning.
Wow.
Of the day in which the convention was to start, when the Credentials Committee votes in a vote of 17 to 16 with one disputed proxy to seat the all-white delegation and exclude the blacks from the South. This so infuriates African-Americans, although for the first time they were blacks from outside the South, but they weren't allowed to be there from the South. And TR supporters are infuriated. And just to pick one name that your listeners will know, W.B. Du Bois feels he can't go with this party. He can't stand Taft. And so to his everlasting regret, he decides to support Woodrow Wilson. But the people were so furious at TR when he made that decision. The amazing thing about these eight men is, I'd really focus on eight black men from Mississippi, was who their children and grandchildren were. As you know, one, the child of one becomes the first federal black judge in the continental United States. Two of them become artists who people to this day would know. One was Ruth Attaway, a star of You Can't Take It With Me in the original Broadway production, and another writes the song Deo, or Banana Boat Song. And just to tell you about one more, the great-grandson of one of those men, one of these men was a poet named Samuel Alfred Beadle. Samuel Alfred Beadle's great-grandson is named Michael Alfred Beadle, and 3 months ago he became the president of the University of Missouri.
Goodness.
Those were the men the TR decided shouldn't be part of his party.
Goodness. Well, let's go ahead, because there are eerie reminiscences of 1968 as well, and what you did at the Democratic Convention in 1968. Did you know about what had happened in 1912 when you were instrumental in changing the Democratic Party rules?
Or I knew much of it, not the black story that I've just told you.
You didn't.
But the story of what TR had done to champion the creation of primaries that year, I knew. I knew a different history of it than I've now discovered by doing the research. But there was a book by a man named George Mowry, a great historian, who told the story of Roosevelt in this convention in a certain way. And that became my Bible. And my hero was TR, because that year, many of your listeners will know and others will have read about, that Bobby Kennedy and Eugene McCarthy won pretty much all the primaries, but Hubert Humphrey, who hadn't run a single primary or won a single primary, became the Democratic Party nominee. And so seeing that happen, I organized a commission that was chaired by Governor Harold Hughes of Iowa. Some of you remember him, and later became a senator. And that commission argued that every state should allow the public to decide who the delegates would be and be able to decide who the president from that state, who those delegates would support for president. And that reform was amazingly adopted on the floor of the convention. Probably people didn't know what they were doing. The Republicans followed suit. So today we have the situation we have where pretty much every delegate is picked that way. And the Washington Post review of my book by a great historian, some of your readers, some of your listeners will know, H.W. Brand, started with this sentence. He said, if Donald Trump becomes the president, he becomes Republican nominee, despite the opposition of the party leaders, he should send a note of thanks to Jeffrey Cowen. I'm not sure that's a note I want to get, but I think it may be true.
Isn't it interesting that we had this kind of willy-nilly system where people had worked so hard and gone through this exhaustive process of being in a primary and the votes ultimately didn't count? You know, in 1912, it was Taft got it because of the party bosses after people had worked their tails off going through primaries.
That's right. And by the way, T.R. might have been able to win it, might have, if he hadn't so infuriated and alienated La Follette. Because he was, as I mentioned, he was 50 votes short. La Follette controlled 36 delegates. But La Follette hated Roosevelt even more than Taft.
Because
he knew that Roosevelt had tried to undermine him. He knew that Roosevelt had tried to take all of his supporters. He thought Roosevelt was a fraud. And so, you know, these two men hated each other, even though they were broadly both thought to be progressives.
We welcome phone calls. If you'd like to join our conversation, we'd love to hear from you. We are, of course, in Wisconsin, so some of you will be familiar with the history of Fighting Bob La Follette and Teddy Roosevelt. We're speaking with the author of Let the People Rule, Theodore Roosevelt and the Birth of the Presidential Primary. Jeffrey Cowan is our guest. He's president of the Annenberg Foundation Trust at Sunnylands and the Annenberg Family Chair in Communication Leadership at the University of Southern California. Also best-selling author of The People versus Clarence Darrow. And he was very, very involved in increasing the importance of the primary and the number of presidential primaries in 1968. Some of you will remember that wild convention that was held in Chicago, and interestingly, the 1912 convention Republican was held in Chicago as well. But any kinds of questions you have as well, as we're in the middle of these, we can ask Jeffrey about caucuses and primaries and what parties have decided which one is best, and superdelegates, when that came into existence. He knows all of this very well. Does it make a difference? Is it much more democratic to have primaries, or should people who know the Democratic and Republican parties best be responsible for nominating those people who they feel will be best? We've heard so much about we're getting candidates who appeal to a core, an ardent core, a fringe core of both parties who do well in the primary and caucus and not necessarily represent everybody who votes. Does it give us candidates who perhaps aren't the best candidates to win a general election? All of that is up for discussion as well. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you right now, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jeffrey Cowan is our guest. His book is Let the People Rule, Theodore Roosevelt and the Birth of the Presidential Primary. It's been getting a lot of attention, fascinating history and explanation of the kind of system that we have now with all of its complexity. Let's go to phone calls for Jeffrey. Rich in Harshaw is our first caller for you, Jeffrey. Hi, Rich.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question to Jeffrey is my daughter, who's at the junior University of Wisconsin-Madison, asked me a question the other day about the origin of superdelegates and whether that is a democratic process using superdelegates, and I unfortunately had to admit my ignorance. So perhaps you can educate us both. What is the origin of superdelegates, and what is their effect on the democratic process?
Rich, thanks for asking that. And, you know, I've thought a lot about how the Jeffrey Cowan of 1968, who had to do with those reforms that we've been talking about, would feel about what's happened today and the Jeffrey Cowan of 2016. The Jeffrey Cowan of 1968 would have been totally opposed to superdelegates. And the rule that was adopted on the floor of the convention in 68, which I had something to do with, said that all delegates would have to be picked through a process which was open to full public participation in the calendar year of the election. So no superdelegates were allowed under that system. But after the McGovern election, did not turn out well, and from the standpoint of the Democratic Party, and then following what happened the next couple of cycles, the Democrats decided that they wanted to restore a role for people who had not been exposed to the electorate in that same way, but who were sort of senior voices in the party. And so the superdelegates, as you know, are so-called superdelegates. They're people who are members of the of Congress, members of the National Committee, and so forth, sort of the party elders. And in the Democratic Party, they represent something like 15% of the delegates. The reason that some people are opposed to them is that it seems that they could sway the outcome of the election. And if the Republicans had superdelegates the way the Democrats do, those are the people who would now, you'd think of as the people who'd be trying to make sure that Trump didn't get
yes.
the nomination. But in fact, just focusing on the Democratic Party, because we do have superdelegates, I don't think there's much of a chance that the superdelegates, even though I don't really believe in them, but I don't think they would go in a direction that was different than the popular vote. So if Bernie Sanders, for example, were to have something comparable to what Trump has in the Republican Party, I don't think the superdelegates would go for Hillary, even if they would prefer her.
Mm-hmm. They're not really, though. I bet if you took a poll of Democrats, I don't know if they'd be wildly popular, would they? Superdelegates?
They might not be. They might not be. I mean, but, you know, it's a club. And so, you know, who would even participate in that poll? The people who are most active and most long-term participants in the party sometimes think it's kind of their party. There was a Republican national committeeman who a couple of days ago said, well, I don't care what the public decides. It's our party.
Right.
Is that
an answer, Rich?
Yeah, well, thank you for that explanation. It does seem somewhat anti-democratic, even though, as you stated, you think that the superdelegates would probably bow to the will of the people, but evidently there's no obligation for them to do that.
There's not an obligation. And I think if it were the Republican Party, and I'm just following this as yours, an interested observer, but I think if the Republican Party had enough of those delegates, they might very well not let it go to Trump. Certainly there'd be a big movement not to. In 2008, Hillary Clinton, for a long time, seemed to be having a lead in the superdelegates. When Obama started to win the primaries, the superdelegate strength began to go to Obama. And I just don't think this year, in the Democratic Party at least, that it could be, if Bernie Sanders really were the overwhelming choice. He's not, though. I mean, right now, it appears that the so-called pledge delegates, that is the people who, by the way, superdelegates can change up to the last minute mm-hmm. while they vote. It's up to them entirely. The pledge delegates, though, have to vote the way the public instructed them to vote. The pledge delegates, the people who have been elected in caucuses and primaries up to now, are substantially for Secretary Clinton. I think that's unlikely to change. One other interesting question is, how should we feel about caucuses?
Right.
I personally don't like caucuses. And the reason for that, there are some advantages to caucuses. They feel like a town meeting. And
yes, they're lots of fun.
Then they're fun.
Yeah.
But they're also, if you believe in a secret ballot, they're not a secret ballot.
Mm-hmm.
Employers.
Right.
Pardon me?
You sure do.
Yeah. If your employer's in the room or your spouse is in the room or your kid's in the room, they're going to know how you vote.
Mm-hmm.
And they also take place during a short period of time, unlike a thing where you have absentee ballots and vote all day, which is what happens with a normal election. If you're not available during those 2 hours, say it's in the evening and you're a firefighter or a nurse or you're a police officer or you have to be home with your kids, you can't participate. So to me, caucuses, I think, are not really the kind of one-person, one-vote democracy that I think is better.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an interesting point. Rich, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Do you think Republicans, though, are kind of wishing they had superdelegates this go-around to stop Trump?
I think some of them are, and I haven't seen it debated whether they would do it the next time. I think if Trump is not nominated this time, I could easily imagine the party creating something like a superdelegate class. You know, as you saw in my book, the Republican Party knew in 1912 that if they had elected... If they had nominated Theodore Roosevelt, he would have won the election.
Right.
So why did they decide to go with Taft, knowing that Roosevelt would run a third party and they'd be almost sure to lose the election?
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that they did was that the Taft faction of the party, the old line leaders, more or less, did not want to give up control of the party. So they decided better to lose the election of 1912 and come back, they thought, and win in 1916 with their kind of candidate, than to not only have Roosevelt be nominated, but probably be elected, and then control the party with his kind of radical members. And I think something like that's going inside the Republican Party
right now. Oh, that's
fascinating.
Right now, yeah.
Even if Trump were to lose the election, he would at least for the moment control the machinery of the party. And that's not something they're anxious to give up.
Yeah, interesting. Rich, thanks for the call. Scott in La Crosse. Hey, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen.
Hi.
I'm on my cell phone, so I'll kind of talk up here.
Okay.
I've been all this election season. Nothing has changed my mind. I don't believe that Donald Trump is serious. I think he's having the time of his life in the greatest reality TV show yet devised. And that being, if that is the case, then if he does get the nomination from the Republican Party, then I think all eyes better be on who he picks for vice president, because my guess is that the Donald is not the kind of person who's going to be able or willing to sit still for 4 years and not move on to the next bright, shiny thing. You know, I just think he's not presidential timber in that sense of the word. And so, you know, I could see him getting frustrated 6 months down the line and say, I quit.
Well,
I'm out of here.
Why do you think he's running, Scott?
Oh, I think, like I say, I think it's this great big lark he's on. My guess is he goes to bed laughing every night that we're buying this. You know, I mean, look at, he's on the top of everybody's talking about him. Geez, you know, for a guy like that, it's just a hoot, I'm sure.
And it's also a marketing ploy. I mean, what fun. He's in Washington, and he holds his press conference in the building that he's putting up.
Exactly.
So it's all a worldwide press conference for his new building. Or he'll have a press conference after Super Tuesday and tout his different products. Or he goes to, he has his victory parties or whatever they are, the election night parties, in a resort that he owns. I mean, I don't know whether what you're saying is right about how he now feels. But along with everything else, and I've never heard of this happening before, this is an incredible marketing ploy for everything that Trump owns. And obviously it's worked badly for some Trump interests, too, because you have a lot of boycotts of Trump products. But he also is just a marketing genius.
Hmm. And what about his vice presidential pick? Would you agree with Scott it's important?
I think it's important anyway. For one thing, in writing my book, I was reminded that when Reagan ran for president, he was going to be turning 70 right after he was elected. And a lot of people thought he was too old to be president. And the primaries gave him a chance to show how vigorous he was, although we know toward the end of his second term, he had begun to have
Alzheimer's.
Decline in serious ways. Trump's that same age. Trump's the age that Reagan was when he ran. We don't think of him as being so old because you have another candidate who's 5 years older.
Mm-hmm.
And attracting young people, that would be Bernie Sanders. Hillary, all of a sudden, who seemed to be old to run, is the kid in the race. But so I think that the choice of the vice president, even if this theory weren't true that he would resign, which I don't think he would, but who knows how healthy he's going to be. So I think you always have to be concerned who the vice president is. Plus, it shows you the judgment of the person running. So I think we'll know a lot from who he chooses as vice president, and I think it'll have a big impact on how people feel about him as a potential president.
Hmm. It is amazing how old all the candidates are. Teddy was, what, 56 during? 50?
He was 53,
53
when this thing starts. He's already feeling like an old man.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have in the White House the man who's just in his early 50s. But all of a sudden, we have we're thinking about an entirely different generation. We're thinking about people who were, you know, in college when Obama was born.
Right. I know. Isn't that true? Well, I want to be eating what they're eating because to a person, they all seem incredibly vigorous. Everybody's running, don't they?
I think so. And I think that probably running invigorates you in a way. But it's an interesting thing. One of the Trump things, and I don't want to stray too far from the book, but you know how he talked about, he said that his big attack originally on Jeb Bush was that he was low energy?
Right.
And then now, more recently, his attack on Hillary is that she doesn't have the stamina.
Right.
Well, those are claims about the same kind of thing. This is a guy who's probably in his pajamas calling in almost the talk shows rather than having to be out there doing it. But I think Reagan proved that with the right group of people around you, you don't have to. You can be president without having to be doing a zillion different things every day.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is we don't know who's around Trump. I mean, I think that if you felt that he had a really solid group of people around him, could delegate well, absorb the material about the things that he had to, could prioritize, I think those would make you feel differently about Trump than somebody who seems like he just says whatever comes into his head. Mm.
Scott, thanks very much for your interesting call. Bob in Coon Valley. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Bob.
I'm walking outside, and I just did an uphill leg, so if I sound a little bit winded, my apologies.
You're fine.
My question, the distribution of primaries, it seems very strange to me. If I was the head of a party, I would want to get a real cross-section perspective on who the people in my party want to be the nominee. In the system we have, it starts off with Iowa, which I understand has a lot of conservative evangelicals, and then there's a relatively small state in the Northeast. But then you go to Super Tuesday, you got all of these southern evangelical states. And so on the Republican side, you tend to, you know, get skewed towards the Ted Cruz's and so forth. On the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton basically said that she won because of the black vote in the South. So you got big states like California and so forth that don't even enter into the discussion of who is going to represent the party. It seems like that system is going to really give you kind of a distorted view of who the people in your party want. So I'm just kind of wondering why the system is like that, and is it not possible to change it such that the system results in a more representative candidate for each party?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question. I don't think there's any ideal system, but I think the one we have has some problems with it. Starting with two rural, largely white states, and you have to wonder what if the first state were California or were New York Illinois? How different would the winnowing process be? Mm-hmm. Because we let those first couple of states winnow it out. There are some virtues to small states, by the way, I think, because you get retail rather than wholesale politics. In a state like California, which is where I live, this is Wisconsin may be sort of in between the two. But in California, it's all a media circus. You know, you have to buy all the television time and radio time and so forth. In Iowa, you really do go to all of these town meetings and so forth, and that's also true in New Hampshire. But I think there is a distorting factor that the caller mentions that I agree with that way. And so people have continually thought, what would be a better system? Well, in 1912, the Democratic Party platform called for a national convention, which, by the way, was also in Wilson's State of the Union message. And the Progressive Party platform called for it, but it didn't happen. And frankly, only the richest and best-known candidates could probably run it if there was just one national convention. The secretaries of state have an association which has recommended that there be a series of regional primaries. But even there, the question is, what region would come first? It would be very different if it was the South than if it was the Northeast. But I totally agree that the system itself should be improved dramatically. And I think it's unlikely to happen, but I think it should happen.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Jeffrey, for having written this fascinating piece of history, which is so relevant to what's happening today. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen. It was great fun.
Jeffrey Cowan, the book is Let the People Rule, Theodore Roosevelt and the Birth of the Presidential Primary. Jeffrey is president of the Annenberg Foundation Trust at Sunnylands and the Annenberg Family Chair in Communication Leadership at the University of Southern California. He also wrote The People versus Clarence Darrow, and he was very much front and center at increasing the number of presidential primaries in 1968 at that convention. ABC Television News called him the man who did more to change Democratic conventions than anyone since Andrew Jackson started them. So that's it for this hour. And thank you very much to Scotty Myers for producing the hour, to KP Whaley for on-air production here in downtown Milwaukee. And thanks for all of your calls, everybody. We're off tomorrow. We're doing a team meeting retreat, which we've never done before. So we'll come back refreshed with great new ideas. John Munson will be behind the microphone, ably conducting interviews tomorrow.